Welcome to episode 176 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Aaryn Greenwood. Aaryn describes herself as an animal writer, novelist, and lawyer. Her young adult book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, was published in 2018. Aaryn was animal welfare editor for the Huffington Post and now writes about dogs, cats and other animals for the Today Show, the Dodo, the Washington Post, Slate, Creative Loafing, the American Bar Association Journal and many other publications. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 175 others in our timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via a review or rating? Reviews, ratings and sharing really help more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate and rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism in your favourite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these sorts of ideas, not just confirmed sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Aaryn. How are you?
Hi, great. How about you?
Yeah, really good, really good. Well, it's a pleasure to have you as a guest on Sentientism. And my ears pricked up to your work, partly because you were interviewed by one of my previous guests, Carl Johansson, for the New Books Network about your young adult book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, which sounds absolutely fascinating. So it'd be interesting to dig into that. So it's wonderful to have the chance to have a conversation because I've listened to you on a few other podcasts already. So it's great to get the chance to have my own conversation. So thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
I'm also really excited about the fact you've had a chance to dig around in this sentientism idea. And I think you've listened to or watched a few episodes already too. So it's great to make this into a bit of a conversation and see what you think of the idea and where it could go. So as you already know, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the deepest philosophical questions, the questions of, you know, how do we understand reality and work out what's real, but just as importantly, what matters and who matters? And I have an obvious bias because of this sentientism worldview I'm trying to popularize, which I summarize as evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So when it comes to that what's real question, it suggests we should take a broadly humble, naturalistic approach using evidence and reason. And when it comes to that ethical question of who matters, as we're working out how to live a good life, the clue is in the name. It's every sentient being, any being that has the capacity to suffer, to flourish, to feel pleasure and pain or joy, or to have interests or to value their own existence at all. But I'm very lucky in these conversations to be talking to a wide range of people, some of whom agree and some of whom don't agree with sentientism. So it'll be really interesting to understand your own philosophical journey and how that underpins what you do today. But before we get onto that, how would you best introduce yourself and your work for those who don't know you and haven't read your writing already?
I'm terrible at describing myself, but I guess I would just say I am a dog lover and animal writer and a former lawyer, and I've written a couple of books. That's how I would describe myself.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. And your work with sanctuaries, I guess, is another important part of what you do now too.
After I was a lawyer, I became a journalist, and I focused on animal welfare. And it was, I mean, I could go on for an hour just about how lucky I was to get to do that. But it tapped into just a deep love I have always had for animals. And also just sort of as you're describing and as you do, sort of examining how animals fit into kind of every part of human existence. So I guess it was very focused on sort of how humans and animals interact and how we engage and how we try to do better and all these sorts of things. And then maybe 5 years ago or so, I moved over to the nonprofit side of things. So I've been on staff now at a couple of animal advocacy organizations. And now I'm on staff at an organization called Austin Pets Alive, which is both a shelter that really focuses on reaching the animals who are most at risk of euthanasia at other shelters and just out in the world, and also sort of teaches across the country how to implement those practices and save more lives. So I'm very lucky to get to work in this space and try to help do some good for animals for a long time now.
Yeah, wonderful. And your writings have, you know, an enormous variety as well, because obviously you went from writing for HuffPost and Washington Post and loads of other different places in a journalistic context, and now you're doing fiction and young adult, you know, arguably sci-fi too, but with, you can, there's some common themes which we'll come back to, of course. So let's start with the first of these crazily big philosophical questions, the question of what's real. And for many of my guests, that's, that starts with a story about how they grew up, whether that was in maybe a mystical, spiritual, supernatural, religious context, or one that was maybe more scientifically minded, maybe atheistic, more naturalistic, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time. But of course, that sort of big natural, supernatural question is only one of the big questions about what's real, but often it's a good place to start. So I don't know if you'd be interested in telling us that sort of story.
Yeah, yeah. I grew up in a Jewish family, and I'm still Jewish, but Judaism, at least in the U.S., I'd be curious to hear how it is in the U.K. too. There's a lot of secular Jews, so I sort of grew up in a very secular Jewish household, which meant that we identify as Jewish. We have a Jewish community. I had a bat mitzvah, which is the Jewish coming of age ceremony when you're 12 or 13 years old. We celebrate a lot of the Jewish holidays, but it doesn't necessarily have a belief component to it. And I would say my parents, I would say, I don't want to speak for them, but I think they kind of go in and out of how spiritual they feel at any given moment. But they strongly identify as being Jewish. I mean, it's part of who we are. And I think that's probably where I am too. I mean, I don't feel like I know enough about the universe to say that there's definitely no such thing as a higher power. I mean, it's like, I barely know what's happening inside my own house most days. You know, I feel like it really takes a lot of sort of belief in your own epistemological knowledge to be able to say that you have a clear view on what is happening out in the physical universe and the spiritual universe. But my kind of instinct is as a secular Jew, and that's sort of where I kind of live in that world.
Yeah, thank you. It implies quite a strong dose of humility there, because I think this is incontrovertibly true, right? We're a type of animal that evolved in a particular context, and our perceptions and our brains evolved in that context. Now, we're a pretty weird species because we've sort of hacked that to go and do all sorts of amazing things that we didn't evolve to do. But it's quite useful to remember that that's where we came from, and that's the sort of hardware we've got. So I quite like the fact you're saying, look, you know, I struggle to know even what's going on in the house, let alone, you know, what's the foundation of physics and is there a God and what does it all mean? I think it's good to be hesitant about how confident we are about those topics. Yeah.
Thanks. I mean, it's just, there are people who know more than I do. You know, there are people who have devoted themselves to studying all of these things. And I believe in expertise and also believe in humility, I guess. I don't know. I can tell you how I feel on any given day, but I have a hard time saying what is actually real and true, other than what I see before us.
Yeah, and I think saying I don't know is an underrated answer. I think I'd probably be happier if we heard a lot more of that. And so it sounds like the idea of, you know, the supernatural or spirits or deities isn't really a force in your life. You don't have a belief in them and it doesn't have an influence on you. But, you know, you're open-minded about those things being possible, I guess. That seems like it's how it feels to you. Those things aren't a major presence in your life, they don't. They're not a guide, they're not a thing that necessarily concerns you that much.
Yeah, I would say that's probably right. And I would say, you know, to the extent that I believe anything, it's that sort of regardless of whether there is a, you know, a universal being or that sort of thing, I think we do have knowable duties to one another. And knowable duty, I guess, sort of like the, you know, your sentientism. I mean, I feel like we have duties to those who can feel happiness and those who can suffer, and, you know, and the hard part is figuring out what those duties are and how they exist in a practical sense and how you're supposed to live your day, you know, with those duties. I guess that's what I think is, what difference does it make in some way if there's some sort of universal being, like you should act in a good way regardless.
Yeah. That's interesting. And we'll come on to that as we talk about the ethical thing. But yeah, I feel a similar way. It's more that basic ethical stance, that consideration for others is more of a solid foundation even than you know, the ultimate nature of the universe, whatever that might be, right? It's almost like, and obviously, I guess that's one of the challenges with some supernatural views, is that it can shift that emphasis. So even compassionate people, you know, if they genuinely think God is telling them to do something awful to somebody else, will, you know, ultimately that overrides their compassion. But I think that's a more solid place to start, is to say these things are incontrovertible. They're sort of built into the what morality even means, those duties.
Although it's interesting to say that, because of course there's the story in the Torah of Abraham and Isaac, where, you know, God does tell Abraham to kill his son. And, you know, I mean, that's a tough one. That one, I feel like people like us with our instincts probably would say, well, if there's a God, surely it's a benevolent God, and the God just sort of wants you to be good and we'll figure out how to be good. But that's not a story about you must be good. That's a story of you must follow my instructions.
Exactly. I mean, that message is, yes, you know, love thy neighbor as yourself. But the reason you're doing that isn't because you care about the neighbor. It's ultimately because of the number one priority, which is do what you're told by the deity, right? And that applies even if you're told to do something absolutely terrible. And ultimately, it's that divine command theory. That is the number one rule. You know, everything else sort of follows on from it. So, yeah, so we can have a sort of hope that the God might actually be benevolent. But if they're not, we still have to do what we're told. So I think that's the message from that.
I mean, it'd be great to have a story, right, of a group of people who convince a God to be more benevolent, to want benevolent things.
This could be your next book, maybe. This could be your next book. Yeah. So let's finish up on this sort of epistemology and ontology topic, and then we'll come on to the ethics, because you also talked about valuing expertise and also, you know, taking things as you see them. And in a way, I think that method, you know, the approach we go about working out what to believe is more important than necessarily whether we have a belief in the natural or the supernatural. So sometimes I blur this idea of naturalism, because there is a naturalistic ontology which says only the natural world exists. There is no supernatural stuff. And I happen to agree with that too, but that's different from a naturalistic method or epistemology, which is about how do we go about working this stuff out. And there's a different set of choices. One would be, you know, faith, fideism, and revelation, or dogma, where you essentially believe something that is given to you, and it doesn't matter what the evidence is, those beliefs stay rock solid. Whereas the naturalistic epistemology is this evidence and reason idea. Very broadly, we know you use information about reality as far as you can, try and understand what it is, which seems like an echo of, you know, as you were saying, using expertise and, you know, engaging with what's in front of you. So my guess, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is that if your views about, you know, the existence of a God or the existence of the supernatural, it feels like you'd probably actually need some naturalistic evidence to justify that, rather than it just being, you know, a priest telling you it's the right answer, or a rabbi telling you it's the right answer, or you having some sort of faith-based revelation in your own mind. It feels like you'd probably want more evidence, and you'd want a rationale to then believe in the supernatural stuff. Or how do you think about the methods? How do you think about the methods, faith versus evidence, I guess?
I mean, I guess this is my advantage of not being actually a philosopher. I studied philosophy undergrad, but, you know, I suppose the advantage is that I don't have to have decided that. I mean, so much of this for me is instinctive. It's sort of what feels right, what seems right. And I mean, it was actually a question that I had for you, and that I always have when thinking about ethics, is where do any of the ethics come from? I mean, it's, you know, we don't really have a first principle. If we don't have God, we don't really have a first principle for any of it. We just have kind of what feels right and what seems right and what we can persuade other people is right, and the world that we want to live in and that we think is the best world. But there's no kind of overarching necessity for it, other than this is the world that we think would be best to live in. But where do you, let me turn the question to you, where do you get your ethical principles from? Where do they arise from?
You're right. For people who've got a more established sort of religious worldview, that comes with a package of ethics, but it also comes with this idea that, you know, there is an ultimate authority, and it's that ultimate authority that justifies the ethical standard. So that's one approach. And I have problems with that, partly because it is directly an appeal to authority, right? And it's not that different from, you know, an authoritarian human ruler that just says, because ultimately it's a threat of violence and punishment, and that's why I want you to do X, Y, and Z. So I draw quite a negative line between, you know, an authoritarian, totalitarian, very powerful human leader telling people just because, and essentially I think that's what a deity is doing, right? Because ultimately there is the threat of burning in hell for eternity if you don't do what you're told, even if that happens to be, you know, killing your own son, for example.
Well, I'll say in Judaism, we don't have hell. So,
Of course. So there's all sorts of different flavors, right? But is there an analogous mode of sort of punishment or consequences for sin, though, that plays that role? Or is it just not there at all? Or is it more?
It's a good question. And I'm not sure the answer, actually. I think it's mostly you'll just really disappoint your mother. That's kind of the ultimate punishment in Judaism, is your mother will very disappointed.
Talking of dictatorial authority, there is one that
loving authoritarianism,
absolutely.
You know, guiding you to the right thing. But
would probably bow down to that authority. I think that's entirely fair.
I think you should. Yeah.
So, and I'm not sure if my mum actually watches these, but we'll find out what she thinks. That's one of my challenges with even the sort of authority there. I think it's also interesting because I don't think it even does the job for me, because there's this thing called Euthyphro's dilemma, which touches on what we talked about before, where you have this idea of, you know, is goodness independent of God or not? Because if what God does is benevolent, and we say, well, God is perfect instantiation of the good and of love, that means good and love exist as standards independent of God, because that's how we're coming to the view that God is good. And if they're independent standards, why do we need God at all? Whereas if good by definition is just what God tells you to do, to my mind, that is almost a sort of, it's almost giving up on morality, because it is purely obedience. Whereas to my mind, it comes partly down to what, you know, how do you define morality? And philosophers will go off on this for days and days. But to me, the core of morality has to be something to do with whether and how we care about others. Whereas if ultimately the reason why you do something is in the end because of obedience to a powerful authority, I don't think that's morality at all. I think that's just obedience and control. So the first thing I do is say, well, I'm not sure that the religious people have got a good, you know, final answer on this either, because I think it's incoherent and full of flaws and often leads to great evil. But your question still stands, which is, okay, well, so what are mine? Let me start with one thing. Even for people who are more of a secular mindset, even sort of atheist people who've moved away from a religious worldview completely, psychologically, I still think we have hangovers from religious ways of thinking in our heads. And I do think this is one of them. And it's essentially this feeling that morality cannot be meaningful unless there is some perfect, objective, external control and definition of it. And I'm like, well, I just don't think that's true. I think we can choose to define morality as caring about others, just as a definition. So, and then I could go into all sorts of other reasons about why it might be in your enlightened self-interest to care about others, and there's reciprocal benefits. I could go into the sort of descriptive evolutionary story about how morality evolved and why mothers care for their children and how that happened long before humanity existed. And now here we are. So there's a descriptive story about why we care about others. So there's all sorts of reasons why I might say, well, this is why we should be moral. But ultimately, I don't think any of them are sort of a perfect final objective answer. I think ultimately it might just be a choice. And if you choose to care about others, that's a moral choice. If you choose not to care about others, that's amorality. And if you choose to deliberately harm others, that's just called immorality. And if someone says, well, why should I be moral? And those arguments fail, ultimately I'll say, well, ultimately it's a choice. And hopefully the rest of us will constrain you if you choose not to be moral. And I'm not sure where else there is to go, right? So on the one hand, I don't feel this need for a sort of a perfect, objective, externally defined standard. I think morality can be meaningful without that. And for me, I think it almost self-definitionally is the choice to care about others. And it also gives me warm fuzzies, which is another important reason. So there's intuition, there's consistency, there's...
Right. And I like the idea that it's kind of internally logical that the ethics has to involve choice, and that it's not ethical without the choice. I mean, I guess this is the whole free will thing. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Do you feel like you've been able to persuade people to adopt this model of ethics? Do you think, especially people who I guess wouldn't have thought of themselves as having to adopt a model of ethics, if somebody is already inclined to have kind of a model of deciding what's right and what's wrong, then I can see them deciding, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, this one's not working so well, I think this one is more persuasive. But if somebody doesn't even have a model of ethics that they're kind of basing their decisions around or basing their thoughts around, do you feel like this is a persuasive one to them, or people are?
Yeah, I think it can be, because partly it's just reassuring. It's saying you don't need to find this perfect, true external answer. You can just choose to be a good person if you want. I think those other answers about the benefits of cooperation and the fact we've evolved to, it feels nice to help each other, the warm fuzzies, you know, those can help as well. But I think it's mainly that just reassurance that you don't need to find the perfect objective answer. You can just free yourself to choose to be a good person if you want. And then I think the other thing that makes it easy, I mean, there are some people, you know, who technologically in a psychological sense struggle to empathize with others. Either they don't have the sort of theory of mind that helps them understand what it's like to be another person, or they just emotionally can't feel any engagement with that. They just, you know, don't or can't care. And for those people, I think it is difficult, but even they can find an intellectual path to not harming others, for example. For nearly everybody else, and I think it is almost everybody has got something you can start with, right? And almost everybody cares about their mother or their children or their friends. Or so, you know, 99% of human cases, I think it's less a question of, you know, persuading someone to recognize that it's good to be good to other people or it's good to care about other people. It's more a question of starting with the values they already hold for whatever reason, and working with that. And one of the important themes there is about, I guess, consistency. And you can start to have these conversations about, well, if you care about X, well, why wouldn't it make sense to also care about Y? And I think that can ultimately take you all the way from, you know, I care about my mother or I care about my child, all the way through to, in at least some minimal sense, I care about all sentient beings. So I think that's quite a productive path.
Yeah, it's interesting though. My husband, so I've been vegetarian since I was 6 years old for, you know, much the same reason that I'll bet a lot of your guests have. Just at that age, I made the connection between the animals that I just enjoyed spending time with and what was on my plate. And, you know, and for me at that moment, it just became unthinkable to keep eating them. But I have lots of other ways that I'm not consistent about this. But I live with somebody, my husband, who, you know, doesn't share that same moral impulse. And so I use him a lot of times as kind of a reality check, isn't the right word, but kind of a, like, what do the normies think? You know, what do people who don't work in animal welfare? Like, I work in animal welfare. I spend so much time talking to people who care about animals and have devoted their lives to animals. And even in that world, there's a lot of inconsistency. Like, animal shelter events will serve meat. And like, I'm on the board of a shelter where we're about to have our yearly gala. And, you know, our director eats meat and the staff eat meat and the supporters eat meat. And it's, and this is something that I've seen a lot sort of, and I'm not vegan, I'm vegetarian, you know, all these years of being, of thinking about
yet.
This stuff.
Yes.
Still, geez, you know, it's, we are all full of contradictions. But, you know, a lot of times, like if we're driving somewhere and we see cows, my husband will get so excited to see the cows. And I'll say to him, I feel sad when I see these cows because I think like they have these beautiful lives today, but like, I know where this is going. And he'll be like, I'm not bothered by it. You know, like he has thought this through and come to the conclusion that it's okay. You know, it's kind of, it's a brutal world with lots of cruelty in it. And that's sort of how it is. And it's.
Presumably he wouldn't apply that logic to intrahuman ethics, right? He wouldn't say it's a hard world. It's a brutal world. You know, suffering is part of nature. So XYZ is it okay to do to other humans, presumably?
I mean, we all sort of live with that though, right? I mean, you and I are talking on computers today. We have phones. The production of these pieces of technology involves a lot of cruelty and exploitation to the environment, to human beings, to all sorts of things. And we live with that contradiction because we enjoy the benefits of it. And we can rationalize it to ourselves as saying, well, I use this computer to write the stories that will help animals. And so, you know, if I do the math overall, it comes to a good. But, you know, I don't know that that's really true. I do it because I want to do it, you know, and I think we make all kinds of choices that are really at bottom. I mean, why do we drive to go entertain ourselves for the day? It's, you know, it's destroying the environment. It's harming animals. It's harming people. It's doing all these things that I think we all agree are existentially terrible. But we do it because we feel like doing it, you know, and our next car we'll get a hybrid. But like,
so there is something valuable in that way of thinking, because basically it's not possible to live a perfectly ethical life in the modern world, right? We're all going to be causing some form of harm to human and non-humans wherever we go. But I guess my worry is that that can lead to a sort of nihilistic, well, therefore, because I can't be perfect, I won't try and improve. And I think it also leads to a bit of a blurring about different types of exploitation, because there's absolutely, you know, exploitation of humans in many supply chains, and there are issues there. But it does still seem to me to be a radical difference between someone not being paid as much as they probably should be and working in conditions that aren't as good as they should be, and I guess what happens in animal agriculture, where the beings themselves are actually, you know, tended to the product and consumed and treated in ways that you understand that are directly, viciously, and intrinsically brutal. Whereas I think in some of the human stuff, you know, there are challenges there, but it's not quite so direct, it's not quite so egregious. And even in some of those human exploitation cases, the individual might not want us to boycott those products because, you know, they might have a job that's not as well paid as it should be, and they're not being treated as fair as they should be, but a boycott might end that job completely. Whereas I think the situation is very different when the exploitation is of such a direct, intrinsic productization of a sentient being, that's why I still regret the harm I cause in the human sphere in terms of exploitation and supply chains and so on, but still feel quite comfortable drawing a very clear line around, you know, animal agriculture and products.
One of the reasons I enjoy working in the animal space, in addition to just because I'm in love with animals, is because I do feel like there are some clear moral lines, you know, and one of the reasons I really like working in sheltering and companion animals is because I feel like animal agriculture is a really tough problem to solve. And what we're going to do about wildlife, it's a tremendously hard problem to solve. But pets, how do we save shelter pets? Like, that's not actually that hard. Like, we're figuring out how to do that. And it's a matter of getting the resources where they're needed and implementing the practices that are needed. And like, we can fix that problem, you know, and the simplicity of it. And not that it's simple, especially right now. I mean, it is a very, very hard time in animal sheltering right now. People and animals both are really suffering right now. But we can see how to solve the problems. It's a matter of actually doing it, but we can see how to solve them. And I like that feeling that, you know, that unlike this sort of quagmire of how do we deal with human suffering, which to me seems so hard, so, so hard and so complex. And, you know, how do you live the life you want to live and the life that you enjoy, the hedonism that you want to participate in. And, you know, when I say hedonism, I mean extremely minor hedonism. I mean, like driving to hike somewhere or something like that. That's
tricky,
all.
Really, isn't it? And I think maybe that's another way of crystallizing how I think about it, because in one sense, with the human exploitation stuff in supply chains, I guess the answer is probably, you know, if we were to talk to those people and say, well, what would you like us to do? They would probably not want us to boycott, because they'll probably lose their jobs, but they would want us to push and pressure and drive for policy and drive the company to radically improve their working conditions and their pay and so on. But they probably wouldn't want us to boycott. Whereas if we could understand, you know, perspective of a dairy calf or a cow, they just want it to not be done at all. Right? They just stop the whole thing. End of story. So again, that's just another way of trying to put how I think of those as being distinct. And in the same way as we would in the human space, you know, if there was a human industry that was, you know, effectively farming humans, right, the message from them would be shut this industry down. It wouldn't be, I want slightly better conditions while I'm exploited. It would be, yeah.
These are good ways of differentiating. And also I want to think it through some more.
Well, so one of the things that was interesting to me is your journey into, you know, through this who matters question, right? So you spoke really early on about just having this sort of central sense that we have duties to others and we care about others. And, you know, nearly everybody, every human would share that in some sense. But your journey about who matters is really interesting. And you've told us some bits of it already. So including going vegetarian at six. So how did that start? When we start thinking about going beyond the human, what sort of relationships did you have with animals as you were growing up? And I'm really interested about how you went from the companion animal story to, you know, having enough concern for farmed animals to go vegetarian. Because as I was saying earlier on, I think one of the most productive ways that we can have conversations with people is everyone has some compassion. Everyone cares about someone else. And interestingly, everybody already cares about pretty much some non-human. So there's a starting point there. There's already an acknowledgement that at least some non-human sentient animals matter. You know, there's the rescue puppy at my feet, or, you know, whatever, or even a wild animal that someone encounters, you know, an injured bird, and, you know, people would just want to care, right? So most humans already have that kernel. They've already gone beyond anthropocentrism towards a sentientist view. So I think that's a productive starting point, right? That gives me some hope. There's some latent ethics, some latent care for non-humans that almost everybody already has. There are so many steps to go between that and a genuine compassion for sentient beings. And some of the steps I think about, you've done work around, right? And I'm interested in your six-year-old self and how that changed. So one is, you know, dogs are an easy place to start, right? Because many humans intuitively love dogs. We have a relationship with them, we care about them. But even within dogs, there's discrimination based on breed and context. There are some dogs that are loved companions, some that are treated brutally as tools, some that are used to hunt. So even within dogs, there's work to do to get people to care about all dogs. We then have this classic challenge of going from the companion animal to the farmed animal. And it sounds like you made at least that partial connection when you were six. So that's a massive difficult step to get over, because animal agriculture is so normalized in our society that I'm very interested in your story about what was the reaction at six when you did that, because that's probably the hardest thing to break through, I think. Then there's the link, which took me a long time too, so I'll be interested to see whether you take this stuff in your journey, of going from the idea of meat, where there's a visceral identification that this is a piece of flesh from the body of an animal that has been tortured essentially and killed because I paid for it to happen, and I'm going to put it in my mouth. All right, so that feels like a visceral, direct ethical connection between a wrong that's been done. So that led me to go vegetarian in my early, you know, 20s, and it took me another couple of decades before I went to the vegan step. But there is a distinction between the meat thing and then the dairy and eggs and the leather stuff, which it's easier, we can convince ourselves it's less direct until we learn about those industries, but it's intuitively easy. And then there's the link from factory farming, which again is reasonably easy to condemn in theoretical terms, to all animal agriculture, because in simple terms, the worst parts of the process are consistent between factory farming and non-factory farming from the animal's perspective. And then one of the really challenging things is going beyond that to even considering non-human wild animals, because, you know, we might feel compassion for a deer that is hit by a car or an injured bird we find in the woods. But as you hinted at earlier on, right, there are quadrillions of wild animals out there. Frankly, we've got no idea how to help them. And often we're harming them in terrible ways too. So I guess the theme there is there's a starting kernel, right? Everyone already cares at least about some non-human animal. And then there's a massive long journey with some really difficult social breakpoints to work through. So to go back to my original question, how did you originally start to think about non-human animals? And what was it like at 6 years old making that connection with food systems? And what sort of response did you get?
I mean, in a way, I think it's easier when you're really young, you know, because you don't have as many habits and, you know, the whole world is sort of new. And so you're open to different ideas and that sort of thing. I mean,
and you've got less bullshit in your head, I think, as well. There's a purity, there's a clarity about thinking sometimes.
Yeah. My parents had this family friend. I mean, I was just so lucky. I can't say enough good things about sort of my parents and the way that I grew up. And, you know, my parents, who I would say are very typical in their attitude toward animals, which is they like dogs a lot, haven't always had one, you know, sort of a couple of times they've ended up with a dog they didn't mean to. Once because of me, I gave them a dog that I had adopted and then I decided to move overseas. And so they got my dog and
inherited,
They treated her like a princess for the rest of her life. This pit bull I had adopted when I was in law school, you know, and anyway, my parents were great. So they had this friend. They had lived in San Francisco in the 60s and had a friend who they made there, Judy, who then my parents moved back east. And Judy was living in Boston, not, you know, about an hour from where my parents were living. And we spent a lot of time with Judy. And Judy was, you know, she was an old school vegetarian. She was, you know, she'd been a vegetarian for a long time. And this is in the 70s that I was talking to her. There were not a lot of like child vegetarians then like there are now, but she didn't have kids. And so I think she didn't know not to talk to me like an adult, like, you know, so when I talked to her about being a vegetarian, she was very straightforward with me about the reasons for it and what it was like and, you know, all that sort of a thing. And I guess like a lot of kids, I just loved animals, just loved them. And, you know, she was the one who helped me put together that love for animals with her diet. And so I came in one day and told my parents I didn't want to eat meat anymore. And they were so great about it. I mean, maybe it was because they lived in San Francisco in the 60s. And so they were open to things or, you know, being friends with Judy. I don't know what it was, but they were just great about it. And they said, basically, okay, but you're going to have to keep eating chicken, I think, just to make their lives a little bit easier. And also because I think that's what probably the doctor said, is that like I needed something. So they told me I had to drink 3 glasses of milk every day and eat chicken still, but I could cut out red meat. And that was that. I mean, there was never any going back and forth, at least not that I remember. I have a horrible memory, so it's possible that at some point I questioned this, but I just remember one day I was sitting in a restaurant. My dad had taken me to New York for the weekend just to go hang out. And he took me to some German restaurant and there was a sausage sitting in front of me. And I looked at it and I said, I can't eat this. And that was that, you know, and my parents were great about it. Yeah, they were really great about it. And then I stopped eating chicken when I was 18. And then I started eating fish when I was in my 30s, because I was living on this is when I was a lawyer, I was living on a Pacific island. And I am a lazy cook and like to eat out. And there was very little vegetarian food available at restaurants. And I realized I was either going to be eating fish or eating other animals. And fish seemed like the compromise, you know, the practical compromise. And I've thought a lot about sort of, you know, because I do believe that fish are sentient and I do believe that fish care about their own existence.
Yeah, the science is very solid now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really solid. Yeah. I don't think there's any way around that. And I think that the fishing industry is horribly destructive. And I think it's both cruel and cataclysmic. And yet I eat a little bit of fish probably once a month. I still eat fish, even though I don't live on the island anymore. So I guess even calling myself a vegetarian anymore is controversial. But it's so deeply ingrained in my identity that I still think of myself that way. But yeah, and I think it's given me a lot of complicated thoughts about navigating the practical versus the ethical and how those two things fit together. And I don't know that I have the answer to it, but as far as this journey that you're describing of the, you know, how do you get people to move from the dog to the pig, to the, you know, I don't know, to the insect. Like, I think we're about to start talking more about insect, you know, insect ethics. I have given this some thought because it's something that I've written about and obviously thought about. And one thing, I don't have all the answers, but one of the things that I've thought a lot about is just how invested people get in these stories where there's a story about, you know, a cow who makes a run for it. When I'm going to cry talking about this, because every time these stories come up, they just hit like a ton of bricks. But a cow who's on the slaughter, who makes a bolt for it off the truck, and then suddenly everybody cares about this cow. And it's something that I've thought about so much, because it's something that we face in sheltering too, which is, you know, there's 500,000 sort of medium-sized brown dogs in shelters all across the U.S. I'm not sure actually it's 500,000, but it's a lot of them. And getting people to care about all of these dogs as opposed to this one dog who gets a viral story about them, and suddenly there's, you know, 150 adoption applications for this dog, but there's thousands of other dogs who you would love just as much if you got to know them. And, you know, and it's just a matter of sort of getting their stories told too, and figuring out how to tell their stories in a way that grab people's attention. I usually think of it almost as like a religious thing, like the individual suddenly captures everybody's attention and is elevated, you know, and now we all care a lot about this cow, this dog, you know, but sometimes I think it translates out into caring for those who are like this cow and like this dog. And sometimes I think it doesn't. And I'm still trying to figure out how it is that you do that and try to sort of expand the circle of caring beyond the individual to the species or to everyone. And
it's difficult, because one response to seeing people's response to that story is to just feel outrage at the hypocrisy. And I understand that, you know, and it's quite a common thing for sort of vegans on Twitter, you know, you see something.
Oh, vegans on Twitter are the worst.
Yeah. And because you see something like, you know, someone kicking a cat, for example, I don't know, some footballer or whoever it was, or recently someone punched a horse in the UK, right? And
yeah.
Then the court case and so on.
Terrible story. Yeah, that teacher.
And it's awful. And it is genuinely awful, right? What's been done is absolutely awful. And you see an outpouring of visceral, aggressive responses from people who still consume animal products. And all of the vegans are like, what? So, and I understand that reaction. But at the same time, I take hope from that. Because as we were saying earlier on, right, these things are difficult. I don't like the idea of making excuses for what we do. We should own up for the consequences of actions we take, but we do live, you know, with family and friends and in society in different places, with availability challenges and different contexts, and with other pressures on our lives, and nobody's ethically perfect, right? So those aren't excuses, but they are just facts of the matter. But I guess what the reason I get some hope from a core philosophy and that core compassion is that, you know, hopefully as we can change systems and make things easier for people to do the right thing, it will unlock their latent ethics, and, you know, change can happen quite quickly. It's not, we almost don't need to persuade people. I mean, people understand what it must be like for a dairy cow to have their calf taken away, right? People understand what happens to male chicks, right? And we don't need to win that philosophical argument. It's, you know, it's a sort of a broader thing. So it's frustrating, but I take some hope from it at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I will just say, I didn't mean to say vegans on Twitter are the worst. They're dead.
I am one, so yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think anyone has ever been persuaded by being yelled at and being told that you're a terrible person for caring about this horse or this cat. And it really makes my heart sink when I see people being attacked because they feel, you know, because what they're feeling is normal. They're having normal human feelings. Like, it hurts to see a vulnerable creature attacked. And I think attacking the people who are feeling that way
Right? We want them to feel that those are good feelings. Those are important feelings. Yeah,
exactly. And I feel like the usual sort of rhetorical twist there of either yelling at them for being hypocrites or, you know, or suddenly sending them a lot of videos of other animals being tortured is the way to turn people off and not the way to engage them, you know, and that exactly as you're saying, it can be so easy to, you know, we have so many delicious plant-based foods now and, you know, and there's good marketing for it. And it's not like it was, you know, 40 something years ago when I stopped eating meat and like, I got a plate of steamed broccoli at most restaurants or a ketchup sandwich. Like, it's not like that now. Now it's pretty easy. And that, you know, the alternatives are not just for people who have decided to forego meat. The options are good for everybody. And so let's sort of celebrate people even as they take tepid steps into sort of where we'd like them to be. I know a guy who started this movement that he calls reducitarianism. And I think it's really
Brian
smart.
Caton.
Yeah, he'd be a great guest, actually. I mean, I guess this is because I'm a namby-pamby incrementalist and an animal welfare person instead of an animal rights person. And I realize that this puts me, you know, in a sort of hated position in a lot of our types of circles. But I do believe in incrementalism. And I do think that if you can get people to do a little bit more, you know, and make it easy and make them feel welcome and make them feel happy to be a part of this, that I feel like it's the way to get more of what it is that we're hoping for and to celebrate when people see these stories and they feel that nausea, I think, that we all feel. Like, we feel the nausea probably over more of it, but that's because we have thought about more of this and we voluntarily put more of this into our heads. And it's horrible to have this kind of torture swimming around in your head. I mean, it's awful. I wouldn't wish this on anybody. But, you know, we've chosen this for ourselves. And so, you know, lots of people are thinking about other things all day. Like, they're not steeped in this. They don't spend all day every day thinking about animals. And so when the stories that provoke an emotional connection come before them, I think we can use that opportunity to invite them a little more in. Like a lot of them end up supporting farmed animal sanctuaries after a story like that. And like, you know, is that going to solve all the problems? No, it's not going to solve all the problems, but it will help some of the animals and it will, you know, it will do something. And also, I think you just don't know which stories are going to really hit. Like, I, you know, not to just talk about my husband nonstop for 2 hours, but you know, there was a story in the LA Times a few years ago about a group of activists who sit vigil for the trucks carrying pigs as they're going into slaughter, you know, and it was a story about how they touch the pigs through the openings in the truck walls and, you know, say prayers for them and do all of this stuff. And you know, I looked at that and I was like, yeah, that's like, it's another example of, and my husband was really affected by it. And for a while it did change his behavior. It's, you know, you just don't know which stories are going to really hit somebody.
I identify a lot with that sort of more abolitionist rights approach.
Yeah.
Just because of the ethical clarity of what's being done. So I do sense that. And I think most people understand that as well, because if you walked out into your front yard and saw the neighbor kicking a dog, you'd have the same response, right? You'd be emotional, you'd shout, you'd call the police, you'd might even intervene with force, right? So I do understand that. And there is a worry that a more reducitarian or an incrementalist approach, there's an understandable skepticism about humans because we're really good at coming up with justifications for things we want to keep doing. And I think there's a worry that the sort of more welfareist approach and incrementalist approach might actually lead us to a dead end. So I think people can imagine a situation, and I think this is entirely possible, where in 10, 20, 30 years, we've basically got an even larger animal agriculture industry, but we've sort of successfully rebranded it as humane and sustainable, and everyone's like, saying, well, didn't we do a good job? The cages are a bit bigger and now we're finished. So I understand that skepticism, but at the same time, you have to deal with the reality, right? And I think you also need to engage with compassion, even with people you disagree with, and even with people who are causing harm, even as you might come to constrain them in some way, So I think you can recognize that, you know, one, I think we have an ethical obligation to deal with each other with compassion regardless. So we should just do that, partly because it's a good setting a good example for how to be compassionate. Two, I think you're absolutely right. We should reward and build on that compassion people already feel for non-human animals. And incremental steps might not go as far as we want, but they are steps, right? And they are better. Doing less harm is better than doing more harm. It's just sort of obvious, right? And it doesn't mean the remaining harm is justifiable, but it's still better than not having reduced. So I do think that, I mean, and people who ascribe to the sentientism philosophy have lots of different views about the best modes of activism and how we can drive change and theories of change. And they obviously have, you know, fierce online battles about that amongst themselves too. But I think there is some common ground there that as long as we maintain the ethical clarity about taking the perspective of the other beings we're thinking of, imagining their perspective, what it's like to be them and their families and what they're going through, and we maintain that ethical clarity, that still opens up a lot of space for us to think about the right tactics and the right ways of making things better and ultimately getting to a point where, you know, I think we'd all love to see no exploitation. And that will involve all sorts of different things having to happen in terms of governance structures and institutions and NGOs and corporates and alternative products and policies and laws and regulations and social change shifting. You know, it's a massively complex thing we're trying to do. But as long as we remember that, you know, the perspective of the other and the end goal, I think that helps avoid the risk that we end up in a sort of welfareist dead end. But it also means we can engage with each other in compassion and try and move towards it rather than insist on a, you know, there's only one way to make change happen. But which I think you're right, can actually lead some people to disengage. Right? I mean, it happens even with slaughterhouse footage, right? There are some people, and my guests probably are these sort of wonderfully weird people who, you know, like you at six, or, you know, read a book or read a pamphlet or saw a video, horrific video, and just decided to make a change, whatever that change was. But I think it's also very common that if someone sees a graphic video of slaughterhouse footage, it's so brutally horrific and their complicity in it is so unsettling that they would just disengage with the topic completely. And that's certainly, you know, my favorite tactic for this whole thing with my slow halting journey to vegetarianism and then veganism was basically avoidance. I wasn't coming up with clever philosophical arguments. I wasn't coming up with justifications. It was a combination of, you know, this feels too socially weird for me, so I don't have the guts to do it, and just deliberately avoiding the topic. And I think it's quite common when people are, you know, attacked or presented with something they just can't compute. It's really hard to condemn something you're complicit in, and we have to understand that and hopefully help people with compassion to find a better way.
Well, and I'll just say, look, I'm not holding myself up as a model of anything, and I'm, you know, I'm certainly no paragon, but when I was a little kid, it wasn't the horror of it that drove me to change. It was love that drove me to change. And I really feel like there is so much burnout and so much compassion fatigue in the welfare world. There's so much suffering. I mean, there is so much suffering. The people who work in slaughterhouses really suffer. And the people who work in shelters who are doing their best, you know, in slaughterhouses, the end mission is sort of inherent cruelty. In shelters, it's just the circumstances right now are so hard. They are so hard. And it really is not just the animals who are suffering, it's the people too. And so I'm really reluctant to put more kind of suffering out into the world, even, you know, footage of slaughterhouses and, you know, hitting people over the head with the horrors of things. I really feel like just seeing in the sheltering world how it's causing so much suffering among people and among animals. And I haven't worked in a slaughterhouse. I haven't been to a slaughterhouse, but I've read about what it feels like for the people who are working there, and it's not good. And I'm really reluctant to put more of those images into people's heads, because I don't feel like we need to increase the amount of that kind of suffering. I mean, on the other hand, I guess it is persuasive with some people, but I sort of feel like giving people the opportunity to feel good about what they're doing is the approach that I would prefer.
I agree. And I think that's, in a way, that's part of the trade, right? Because there's a sort of ignorance is bliss start at the beginning where you just don't engage with this thing because you sort of know you don't want to know. And then there's a trade as you go through maybe the vegetarian journey and certainly the vegan journey, where on the one hand, you are opening your eyes to just some egregious, vicious, disgusting horror. So that's an enormous amount to take on. And, you know, people use the term dystopia to describe what it's like to live in a society that thinks that's normal. I mean, it's genuinely psychologically the most bizarre thing I've ever experienced, is to walk around and see this stuff and talk to these people. I mean, it's weird, right? But on the other side, as you said, there is that sense that you're acting out of compassion or even love, that you're freeing yourself, at least to some degree, from the cognitive dissonance and from your complicity in it. You know, you're trying to make a change. And that's why I think it's quite common that for people who haven't gone vegan, it can be, you know, socially concerning, it's practically concerning, it can feel like a sacrifice, or you're giving something up, or you're constraining yourself, or it's a diet. Whereas for the people who've done it, for, you know, ethical vegans, it's more about, it's a sense of freedom and a joy and an act of compassion. And yes, that does come with a recognition of something terrible. Yeah, but it's a trade I hope more and more of us will take. And as more of us would do it, you know, the horror will dissipate and we can all look back and be glad that we helped to drive that change. And I know I need to let you go soon, but one of the things I was really interested in understanding from you, given your work, both in journalism, but also in writing books like Robot Dog, is what role do you think, you know, journalism, writing, fiction, narrative might be able to play in not just entertaining people, but actually doing what we've been talking about, you know, taking that germ of compassion and helping broaden it out more. And if you want to tell us a little bit more about Robot Dog, just to pitch the book, because it's, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. The reviews are awesome. So I don't know if you want to thread that into the conversation too.
I mean, this is something that I've thought about a lot. Oh, I also just want to say, you were talking about welfarism being kind of a dead end and greenwashing, you know, where we feel really good that we've given pigs an extra 6 inches of cage to turn around in, and now the problem is solved.
And we've completely redefined the word humane from meaning kindness and compassion, which is what it does actually mean, to we're going to torture you slightly less before we kill you so we can eat you. So is it ethics washing and a greenwashing? Yeah.
Right. And I guess what I would say is that as a welfare person, more than a rights person, I don't know that I'm making the right distinction by saying this, but this is the category that I seem to feel more bumped into, that until we can get to the point where, you know, where people aren't sort of relying on an egregiously cruel, unthinkably cruel, immoral beyond compare system that just in the US alone encompasses 9 billion animals a year, you know, until we're at the point where this is not sort of the institution that is feeding so many people, but people who have other choices, people who, for whatever reason, don't feel that they have other choices, you know, I will take the steps that we can get along the way while we work for better. And I don't think that it should end the fight, but I do think that as horrific as the industry is, if we can make it so that the pigs can stand up and turn around instead of being trapped so that they can't turn around, it's still egregiously awful, but it is one step better. And I think if you ask the pigs, you know, would you rather not be able to turn around or turn around on your path to being tortured? They would rather be able to turn around. And so as we work to kind of reform the whole system so that it's not, I mean, I really believe, and maybe this is me being too much of an optimist, but I believe it's not going to be too long from now that we look back and are just can't believe that we allowed this to go on for so long in the way that it has, in the way that it is. I really believe that. And, you know, I've said it'll be a decade, maybe it'll be more than that. We'll probably have steps forward and steps back. I mean, I don't think it's going to be one straight line, but, you know, this system is unthinkably cruel and needs reform from top to bottom. And in the meantime, I will take the incremental steps because I think it makes life marginally better for the animals who are forced to be a part of it.
I think that's entirely fair. And the way you describe that is you know, taking their perspective, what would they prefer, right? And of course, they would prefer not to be tortured and killed at all, right? But if there's certain things are just less bad, right? So, and if they're steps on the right path, then let's, and I sort of share that optimism, and I wonder if it's too naive sometimes, but I think change can happen very quickly, right? Because we have this latent human ethic that people already philosophically know that it's a bad thing to be doing and agree already. You know, most people would not do that themselves. They would not do that for a glass of milk or for a, you know, fried egg or for a, you know, chicken sandwich. People would not do it themselves, not just because of a, you know, disgust response, but because ethically they wouldn't do it. They would not take that choice. So I agree. That's one thing that gives me some hope things could change quickly. The other thing is that technically this is a really easy problem to solve because we already grow four times more plants than all of the humans on the planet need to eat today. And fortunately, plants are edible. And then when you add in the new technologies and the plant-based stuff and maybe cultivated meat and, you know, the food innovation and the, you know, leather replacements and all of that, those sorts of things, you know, this is not, it's socially a challenging problem, but technically and ethically, it's almost trivial. So I think we could actually see it happen pretty quickly, but, you know, we'll see. Maybe I'm just naively optimistic.
Well, I mean, what you can imagine, it's because it's all those things, but it's also how do you get these things to the consumer? McDonald's is everywhere. You know, everyone is familiar with it. Everyone knows where the closest McDonald's, not me because they don't have a vegetarian, but most people know, you know, where their closest McDonald's is and that it's going to be.
Ours has a Beyond Burger.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Just up the road, yeah.
See, but I think that's what it's going to take. I mean, I think it's going to take some smart entrepreneur who, you know, who's like, why don't I start a fast food chain and put them everywhere, and people will get used to it and it'll be good. It has to be cheap, and it can't be something where people feel like it's a struggle to pay for it and to access it, and then they don't really like it. Like, it has to be as cheap as the other food that we're asking them to eat those instead of, and you know, as accessible to them and tasty and all the things. But I think I share your optimism. Again, I'm like a little Pollyanna optimist, you know, I don't know, but I do feel like they're solvable problems. And, you know, I'm sort of hopeful, I guess, because I can't believe we're going to have the apocalypse that seems before us, but I have to believe that technology and capitalism will help save us from these things. Like, as terrible as capitalism can be, it also offers a lot of consumer-y kinds of solutions to problems that we see. And I hope that the right products and the right supply chain and the right marketing will just help make these problems less about having to convince people that they need to adopt a whole new way of thinking about the world and harm reductions and trade-offs. And, you know, are you willing to step on ants to go for a walk in your park? And, you know, all of the issues that are super fun and I think super important. And I love sitting here talking, like, I really, honestly, I could sit here all day talking with you about this stuff. I think it's great, but also people are busy. You know, they're busy. They're trying to pay their rent and their rent is really high and food is really expensive. And how are they going to pay for their kids to go to college and all of this stuff? And so
I think that's entirely fair, right? We can't expect many people to take an ethical imperative and drive that through their existing lives with high friction, right? We have to make it cheap, fast, easy. We have to work against some of the cultural blockers because for some people, you know, meat, dairy, and eggs are just, you know, an emotionally important part of their lives. We need to help work through that. But then I do think we need to help them through that so that they can then free up their latent compassionate ethics. Because I think there is another worry that if we make it just cheap, fast, and easy, we would do a sort of ethical bypassing. And I think there's a worry that, you know, if we haven't allowed ourselves to actually engage with these ethical topics, at least in a basic way, you know, who knows what horror comes next, right? We're already spooling up insect farms and people are trying to start octopus farms. And, you know, I don't know what other horrible thing we'll do next, right?
Octopus farms rip my heart out. The idea of it is just so,
So I think the cheap, fast, easy and the, you know, help people through it without having to bang them over the head with the ethics is important, as long as it frees them to get to a ethical clarity rather than just sort of bypassing it and then drifting into some know, the next human atrocity when we haven't even fixed these ones. But
no, I think that's fair. And I think also, I like that you're giving people a lot of credit. I like that you're holding people to a standard, but also believe that this is what our minds want.
I think so. Deep down, people, this is a weird thing to say, right, given how few people are actually vegan. But I think, you know, the vast majority of humans, in essence, have a vegan ethic already, right? Because veganism is simply a philosophical stance that is against needlessly causing the exploitation, harming, and killing of non-human animals. Who would actively want to harm, kill, and exploit, right? So in a way, in a weird sense, and again, I don't want to be naively optimistic, right? Because there's a whole world of difference between sort of having that philosophical intuition and then putting that into practice, which is obviously a really important part of veganism as well. You know, enormous number of humans around the world already agree, right? So that, again, that comes back to our, you know, hopeful stance earlier on, really, that we can make it easy for people to put that into practice, then things could change. And so what do you think of the role of journalism and writing and narrative and
Journalism and storytelling? I speak about this topic at animal welfare conferences. I was just at a conference in August talking about exactly this, about storytelling and the role of storytelling. And you know, I speak there for an hour, so I'll try not to do that now. But I would say, in short, you know, storytelling has real power to help bring people along to where it is that you would like them to go. If you tell stories that are authentic and truthful and have some meaning to them, and also that are emotionally resonant, and that can mean all kinds of things. It can mean in some of these cases that they're very sad. I tend to stay away from the very sad stories, but that give you some hope, that give you some opportunity to help. Stories that are funny, I think, really reach people. You know, stories that are surprising, I think, really reach people. I think there's all kinds of ways to reach people. And I feel like once you reach people emotionally, you have the opportunity to get from their heart to their head. And it's a powerful medium. And it's how we understand the world is through stories, you know, and that's why these stories are so important. That's why the stories of the cow who gets off the slaughter truck and is running for their life and then gets saved and gets sent to a sanctuary. I mean, why does anybody care about this cow? You know, the people who care about this cow are generally not people who have given a lot of thought to cows, I think. But, you know, there's something about a story like this that the word that I often use, that, and I would be curious what word you would use, because it's probably a different one, but they humanize the animals. You know, they make people identify with them as creatures who have agency and have wants and have, you know, and have the will to live and are fighting for their lives and are fighting to have a good life. And I think we can all relate to that. You know, it's sort of what we all want. It's, we all want some freedom. We all want to be free of pain. We all want autonomy and love and, you know, a nice field to run around in. I think we all want that, you know?
Yeah. Or a mud pit to wallow in, or
a mud pit to wallow in. Yeah. That, oh gosh, we're fostering a dog right now who will probably end up adopting, who is 80 pounds of puppy chaos. And he loves nothing more than to run, and then roll around in mud. Like, and who can blame him? It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I have this habit of just doing a find replace on the word human for sentient. So I'd probably call it sentientize it. But you end up with too many syllables, because I think in a way people might object to the word humanize, because humans shouldn't be the only ones that matter. So we shouldn't have to humanize to care. But of course, that is also a powerful starting point, because one of the core things about empathy and sympathy and compassion is imagining you were the other, right? And we're humans, and you know, we know humans don't like suffering. So that is a solid place to start. I don't think anthropomorphizing is always bad, right? Because we actually have a lot in common with other animals. There's a scientific basis for us imagining what it might be like to be there. And we can overdo that, of course, right? Because we can impute things to non-human animals that are just human, and you know, we force that on them. Certainly the more basic and the more important things about their lives, their values, their interests, you know, not wanting to suffer, wanting to be with their families, you know, wanting autonomy, wanting the things you talked about, rolling in the muddy puddle, right? We can identify with those things because, you know, we are sentient animals too. Yeah. So I'd probably say, you know, just to sentientize, but it's a bit of a mouthful.
No, that's a good word too. And caring for your offspring. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, that's another type of story that people find very resonant is, you know, stories of, and they can be story, you know, videos or written stories or all kinds of things, but about animals caring for their offspring and fighting for their offspring. And I, you know, I don't have human children myself. So I'm sometimes surprised by how strongly people respond to those stories, but they really do. I mean, they really trigger something powerful in people. And I think it's possible, even if it doesn't happen today, you know, I think these stories embed themselves in people's heads. And I think that they do, they water the seed of empathy, I think, and grow.
And I'm seeing more, I mean, your work is a great example of that, but we're seeing more and more of this in different formats too. So, I mean, a couple of films that spring to mind are Gunda and Cow, and but just brilliantly tell the story of an animal, you know, as closely as we could possibly get through the medium of film to what it's like to be them. It is a deep exercise in empathy and then hopefully compassion. And I think you can do that in writing too. But as you said already, one of the, if you like, the easy hook for human narratives is connecting with individual stories. And we find this in humanitarian stuff as well, right? There's some fascinating psychological research where if you do an ad with one young girl in a war zone, people will give more money than if her brother's standing next to her, right? Because then there's two people and there's a family. And when you start talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, people's brains switch off. Are there ways of using narrative and storytelling and fiction and journalism to go from the individual to the system to big problems as well, do you think?
I think it's really hard because systems feel overwhelming. I mean, I think that's part of why we're struggling so much with climate change.
Again, we didn't evolve to think about that sort of stuff, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, individuals, we feel like, maybe I'm projecting too much here. You know, we talk a lot about anthropomorphism. Maybe I'm projecting my brain into everybody else's, where I find it much easier to focus on an individual than to focus on a system. I mean, thank goodness there are people focusing on systems, because, you know, if everyone had my brain, we'd be in a lot of trouble. You know, when you think about newspaper articles, they start with an anecdote, they move on to describing how this fits into the, you know, a system as a whole, or the problem as a whole, or solutions as a whole, and then ends again with an anecdote. And I think you just keep trying to tell those stories. And I think also, the kind of mantra that I live by is you have to offer people hope and a way to help. And I really feel like that has to be kind of, it's at least a part of the stories that I try to tell. And I try to include it in stories, because I feel like if you want people to change, you have to give them hope that things can change, and you have to give them a way to help. So I think presenting
something they can do. Yeah.
Something they can do, whether it's choosing the Beyond Burger for dinner tonight, or adopting a shelter pet, or donating to a sanctuary, or whatever it is, you know, something small, something big, but just something that they can do that feels, yeah, that feels attainable and that feels meaningful. You know, I really feel like those are how you get people to change their ways, is, you know, and I don't even want to say that's how you get people to change their ways, because that feels manipulative, and it, how you can draw people into your team, you know, how you can help them be a part of what it is that you'd like them to be a part of, is offering them a way to feel good about it and some step that they can take that they can actually do.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a great message to wrap up on. Before I let you go, do you want to tell us a little bit about Robot Dog? I've heard you say elsewhere you're rubbish at self-promotion. So I'm going to give you a nudge. Your publisher will be happy with me.
Yeah. Okay. So my book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, it actually came out a while ago now. It came out back in 2018. It is a story set in a place called Dog Island, which is a sanctuary for what we come to believe is the last real dogs on Earth. Hello, puppy. Hello,
Luna's gorgeous. Listening.
Hi, Luna. Sorry, I get distracted by dogs everywhere I go. I can be on the most important phone call of my life, and if I see a dog, forget it.
I spoiled your flow. Apologies.
Yeah, no, it's okay. No, you introduced something important into it. So it's the story of this place called Dog Island, a sanctuary for the last dogs on Earth, and also the new generations of robot dogs, the dog islanders, the people who live in this sanctuary, test out the new generations of robot dogs. And, you know, these are supposed to replace the organic dogs out in the world since they don't exist there anymore. And our main character is a 17-year-old named Nano Miller, who has grown up in this place and thinks of it as not only just sort of the best place on earth, but really the only place on earth. But then she comes to discover a sort of dark secret that throws it all into uncertainty for her. And she has to leave home and go search for what's the truth and go fight for what she thinks is right and discover the world and exist in the world and then come home with a new way of doing things, which I guess sounds very abstract, but there's exciting scenes. Yeah. And there's just a love for dogs and a love for animals that goes through the whole thing. And when I was writing the book, I really hoped anyone who read it would come away, first of all, just wanting to make the world a little better for animals, but also would want to adopt a dog and possibly also adopt a robot dog. Yeah. And I should say too, it's been optioned by, this is sort of the newsworthy part of it since it's an old book now. It just recently got optioned by a company called Centerboro Productions that is trying to make an animated series out of it, which would awesome. Be very cool. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's all a little uncertain because of the Hollywood strikes and also, you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty anyway, but the company is great and they have amazing ideas for this and I hope it happens.
Yeah, wonderful. I hope it comes to fruition. My two most dog-focused guests so far have been Mark Beckoff and Jessica Pierce. Wow. And you probably got some of their books on your shelf because I know you've got a dog collection. So this will be a really nice counterpoint to have a sort of fictional story about dogs and maybe an animated movie too. Yeah.
Your lips to dog's ear.
Yeah. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you and it's been great to have you as a guest on Sentientism. Is there anything else you want to say about either the big questions that I think we've given brilliant answers to or otherwise how people can find you, how much, you know, whether you do social media, yeah, your website. I can include links in the show notes, so don't worry too much. But where would you point people?
I'm one of these dinosaurs who's still on Facebook. A lot of dog stuff is still in the Facebook world and I still enjoy it. It's just my name there. I guess reluctantly, I'm still on Twitter. It feels very sort of morally dubious to still be on Twitter.
I'm still calling it Twitter. It's a small act of rebellion.
Oh, yeah. It's a disaster. Yeah, and I have a woefully unupdated website too, just my first name, last name.
Cool, brilliant. I'll include those links in the show notes. Well, thanks again for spending so much time with me. Enjoy the rest of your day and it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you. Please stay in touch.
Thank you, Jamie. I really enjoyed it.
Cheers, Aaron.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?